help my DTC grow. Strategies and quick wins that build up 8-figure DTC brand.
How can understanding human behavior skyrocket your conversion rate? Matt Scraesbrook, founder and director of optimization at WeTeach CRO, leverages his decade-long experience in B2B and B2C industries to drive business toward substantial improvements in their conversion rate. With a keen focus on human behavior, Matt's approach to conversion rate optimization is uniquely customer-centric, yielding effective and consistent results. Clients like Nando's, GoDaddy, and Sage have already benefited from his guidance. Tune in to glean insights from his vast experience and unique perspective on CRO. You will get the answers to the following questions. How can understanding human behavior revolutionize your approach to CRO? What are some essential questions you need to ask as a D2C brand that wants to grow? What initial steps should you take to implement an effective CRO strategy?
And of course, I'm here to help your DTC brand grow, so I ask all my favorite questions at the end. Books to read, mistakes to avoid, quick growth tips, and tools to use. Now let's get ready!
I spoke with Sander Voldaba. He works with Niels Koppelman from 3Tech, and he also said that experimentation is the most crucial thing that he ever encountered. So experiment, even just, 10 minutes a day, and it will bring value for the table.
Oh yeah, that applies to so many different things as well. Again, this isn't just a websites related question. It can work in multiple different parts of both business and I guess life as well. We worry so much about what if something goes wrong that a lot of the time we do nothing. It's like, I don't even want to try. I try and look at things, it's probably years of being in CRO, but I try and balance decision making based on how easy is it to reverse. How much time or money would it cost to reverse a decision that I made? If the answer to, how much time and money is relatively little, then do it. If it doesn't work, back it out.
Yeah, and decision is better than doing nothing.
Yeah. You only get success out of action. You don't get it out of inaction.
Yeah, if you decide, you won't get dilemmas. You will get just problems to solve. So just decide what you want to do. Yeah, and what do you think? What is the unique way that you are seeing CRO?
I've always been very careful not to tell people that, my way or our way is better than anyone else's, because I think that, I see a lot of work from other agencies, especially, and a lot of it's damn good. you look at it and you think that's some really impressive stuff in there. I think for me, the big bit that matters is structure and process. My experience working with certain businesses for long periods is that what they really lack is a structure and a process in which to input the good ideas they already have about how they might go about improving things. The businesses we work with, they know their businesses and their organizations far better than we ever will. It's not my job to know their business better than them. It's how do we take the structures that we use and the process that we use to help them get the best out of what is often a lot of good ideas that already exist within those organizations. So yeah, I guess I'm not sure if it's unique. I'm not sure I would label it that way, but that's the approach that I see it. It's a team game. It's a combination of what the client is going to put in and their knowledge and ours around how to then funnel that into something that's productive for the business.
We spoke before, and I know that you were on the client side before you started your agency. How has your transition from client side to running your own agency shaped your approach to CRO?
I mean, I've learned a lot. the Dunning-Kruger effect,
yeah,
where it has the peak of Mount Stupid. Oh yeah, been there. Yeah, no, I think firstly, I think there's great value in anyone working in CRO, or to be honest, any other industry, working both client side and agency side. It really helps when you're talking to, the other side of the fence, that you understand what it is like from their side, what the pressures are like from that side, because they are wholly different. I even tell my own team, people who work in my agency, who might be early in their careers, I even say to them, you won't work here forever. I do recommend taking on a role client side and seeing which one works for you. Like, I did client side first in my career, then I worked in a couple of agency side vendors, Web Trends Optimize and Oracle Maximizer, before I started my own agency. But when you land in one of them, you'll work out which one is right for you. Like, when I got my first agency side job, it was a few weeks in, I was like, oh, this is where I belong. It suits me, but it doesn't suit everyone. But yeah, I think that the perspective from both sides is really valuable.
Yeah, and you said that you're focusing on processes and structure when you're approaching CRO. How would you start as a D2C brand who wants to grow to start these processes or fine-tune their already existing processes? What would be the questions that you would ask?
The first part is understanding what they already do and what they already know. And that's basically a question of data collection. You know, how well is that collected? How well is it presented? You know, how accessible is it within the business? And how many people actually use it to inform decisions on a daily basis? Because what you'll often find is that it exists, but it isn't used. Conversation I had, this was with a D2C commerce brand a couple of weeks ago, got onto the call. One of the co-founders was on that. And I asked him, you know, so what's the lay of the land? What's going on right now? And he said that he had a bit of CRO experience and had done some things himself, but they might need to, you know, in order to do it properly, say they needed some external support. Like, cool, fine. So the first thing I asked him was basically, do you know what these three different rates are? So it was anything from everyone who comes to the site, what percentage of them don't bounce, so visit to non-bounce. Then of everyone who doesn't bounce, what percentage go on to add to basket? And then of everyone who goes to add to basket, what percentage go on to buy? We use those as a top line view. So for example, if with a site, you know, if you're looking for a conversion rate around 2.5%, you're looking roughly speaking 50, 10, 50. So 50% non-bounce, 10% of those then add to basket. 50% who out of those who add to basket go on and buy. That will get you to 2.5%. All sort of averages like that are a little dangerous because it will differ by business, but just as an example. And the first thing that this guy realized when I said that is he went to look at what their bounce rate was. And the answer was about 75%, and he was like, oh, I didn't realize that was, you know, that high. And then we were talking about specific products and they found out that their main product, which 50% of their traffic lands on that product page, the bounce rate on that was about 81%. And yeah, the thing is, I actually did myself out of a job probably because I'd explained that to him. The follow-up conversation we had with him was, he basically said, look, I need to go away and I know what some of the core problems are now. I need to go and fix, you know, these are some big fixes that need to be done. But it's things like that, you know, it's almost looking at it. It's not that he didn't understand what they sold, because he knew all of his numbers about what they sold, the types of products, who they sold them to, what channels those came through. But that's because he asked different questions to me. You know, my first question wasn't, how many things are you selling? It's we call them step conversion rates. And I was like, what are these three rates? And when we went through that, it immediately flagged up what the biggest challenge to his business was that their bounce rate was so high that they were severely throttling their ability to sell a greater volume because so many people didn't stick to the site. So yeah, it's a long answer to a short question.
That's why I'm asking these questions, you know.
It's easy for you to ask and harder to answer, right? But yeah, that's where I would start. I would understand those three rates: visit to non-bounce, non-bounce to add to basket to sale. Use a rough benchmark of 50, 10, 50 within it. See where yours sort of stack up against that. That will isolate an area of the, it's not necessarily just an area of the site. It's also the decision points that a customer needs to get to. So first they need to decide to stay on the site, then they need to decide to add something. You know, basically they need to be guided to pick a particular product from the set that you have, and then lastly they need to choose to actually pay for that product. Those are the three decision points that those step conversions actually apply to.
Are there any limitations to increase all these three touch points? For example, different strategies need different touch points or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, limitations wise, so one of the most obvious ones, if you look at the, you know, towards the end of the funnel, add to basket to sale, so many D2C businesses are on Shopify and there is a very, very limited amount of control that you can exert past that point. We see that frequently. When we see it, the conversation is often around how important your basket page becomes within that structure. It is the last place where you as a brand can really talk to a potential customer about the value of the product, you handle any objections that foresee them having about not buying from you. Because once they leave that basket and they're into the Shopify checkout, any narrative, you know, any brand narrative or any practical narrative, it disappears. It goes out of your hands at that point. So a lot of sites will use a mini cart within Shopify, which it looks swish, but it doesn't give you a lot of space to talk or to pass messages on. Whereas, so we've run tests numerous times with Shopify clients where we've reinstituted an actual cart page because it gives us a bit more space, particularly on desktop, to be able to explain okay, well, if you don't like it, you can send it back this way. The delivery, it will take this long. It will arrive within X number of days. You've made a good choice on this product. You know, here's, again, a reminder of the reviews that this product has. All of those little bits that, you know, you just want to, you want one last opportunity to really get across before somebody then moves into that, you know, I'm now going to have to exchange money for this mindset.
What do you think about the term that revenue optimization is conversion rate optimization also? So at the end, revenue and profit is what matters. And how to apply CRO strategies to see this North Star metric as the center focus of your strategy? Or is it needed to be like that?
Businesses will always seek returns on investments that they make. And those returns are financial. That's what is expected. You know, they're businesses, they're not charities. Even charities expect returns on the investments that they make as well. I personally don't see it being a negative. I think where it can become a negative is where the drive for that revenue or profit maximization is often the phrase that I use for it rather than optimization. It's, you know, maximizing revenue or maximizing profit. Where it can become dangerous is where it becomes very short-sighted. And it is only looking at, you know, what revenue or profit can we make today or tomorrow. That often results in changes that only prioritize today and tomorrow and do so at the cost of next month, next quarter, next year. You know, there's, well, it's been in the news this week already, hasn't it? Amazon are being sued for dark UX patterns for keeping people subscribed to Prime. I don't know if you've seen that one yet or not, but there lies an example of where they have prioritized, short-term prioritized, revenue slash profit, whichever way around, probably both in their case. But that is potentially at the cost of the long-term value. People are now going to, you know, that even that news story coming out, how many people today across the world, I think it's like there's about 200 million people subscribed to Amazon Prime at the minute. How many people across the world today, having seen that story, are going to go and check if they're paying for it?
Three times more, at least.
I'm really curious to see, will the subscriber numbers to Prime tank because of that? You know, all right, it's an extreme example, but it is a good one for saying, okay, they are prioritizing something, but they've prioritized it short term, not long term. So yeah, I think the pursuit of revenue and profit is not a CRO thing. It's a business thing. It's what they exist to do. So I think you could ask that same question of just about any marketing or, you know, sort of revenue driving discipline. I think the reason it gets more focused on from a CRO perspective is purely about measurement. It is very, very easy to measure what revenue or profit came through a specific test in a way that, you know, working out how it came through your press ads, for example, is not as easy. So its measurability is almost its biggest enemy in there, but it's also its greatest strength. I personally love being able to see like actually direct results of the things that either I or my team have done. I don't think it is an issue as long as it is balanced with the long-term benefits. You know, do you want to build a business that grows from, you know, 500,000 turnover to 5 million in a year and then flares out the year after? Because that's what will happen if you try and drive only money out of people. You know, there has to be more to it than that if you want something that's going to last.
And one broad question, what do you think about personalization? How could it be used for CRO much better than it was before?
I did an interview with David Mannheim for his personalization book.
I also did.
So yeah. I can't remember how many interviews he did in the end, about 170 or something. But yeah, for me, I see personalization as a subset of CRO or experimentation, whatever phrase you want to add. And I say that because there is a dangerous belief that has perpetuated for as long as I've been in this industry, which is about 11 years now, that personalization is inherently positive. It isn't. I've seen it tank numerous times where you've tried to personalize something and, you know, you've run it as an A/B test and it is patently worse. So that's why I believe it needs to be a subset of experimentation in itself, because anything that you run that is personalized, it needs to be tested against the version that is not, because you don't know whether it's better and I don't know if it's better. As I said earlier, you need to it's your customers, your users, they're the ones who are going to dictate whether it is or not. Why doesn't it get used as well as it might do? I think inherently it's more complicated than people think. To get something that is genuinely personalized. The problem stems from the number of different data points that you've got to work with and how well connected are they to whatever system that you have to deliver that personalization. Let's use something at a very, very basic level. You want to put something live that shows different types of banners to people in different countries. There's an argument as to whether that's even personalization, but you know, we'll just use it as a basic example. So I'm saying, oh, you know, this is a great deal. It's only available in Scotland. Okay, great. And I know that because your IP address says that you're in Scotland. But how many people use a VPN these days? Is that person in Scotland or are they in the US? So the issue is that you're using one data point, IP address, to say, oh, this is the thing we should personalize on. If you add another piece of data which says, you know, for that same customer, which is, I don't know, say their address is in the US. So are they in Scotland? Or, you know, and therefore would you, you know, if their IP was in Scotland and their address was in Scotland, you know, maybe then you trigger it. So yeah, it's then each person, each human, each user that you're going to have has an infinite number of data points, and you're never going to know them all. So you always run the risk of showing something that actually doesn't make sense for those people. I think one way around that is a lot of what we do in CRO and therefore personalization as a part, we infer things. We look at data and we say, if this, then that. One way around that is to just ask questions. So instead of going, oh, I think this person's trying to do this, it's like, you can just run it as a, you know, you can run surveys, which will give you visitor defined information rather than you saying, I think this person's this. It's this person saying, I am this. When you then personalize on elements like that, it becomes a lot easier because it's not you assuming something. It's that information that somebody else has given you with intent. So, yeah. So that's about a 3 week long conversation we could have about personalization and why it hasn't been used well.
And we would sound the really old people for young folks, you know, like with enthusiasm and everything, like, oh, you could personalize like this and this and this. And you said there are some setbacks there.
I think as David's mentioned numerous times, it's like the year of personalization has been every year for the last decade, at least, where people are like, this year it's going to be good and we will have cracked it and it will be great. And it hasn't happened.
Yeah, yet. It hasn't happened yet. And maybe with AI and all this stuff, personalization would be in person. So who knows? Who would we trust? Yeah. What could be the steps of a D2C brand who wants to grow to deep dive into CRO on their own? Or do you recommend this or not? As an agency, yeah, talk against yourself.
No, I've had this discussion with numerous people over time. There are some who believe that if you're going to start, you're better off starting with an advisor of some kind, you know, someone who has been there and done it before. I see the value in that. Of course I do. I run an agency who effectively advises and runs CRO programs for other businesses. However, I would say that a lot of the clients that we work with and have worked with over the years, most of them have started something on their own. They have come to us or, you know, agencies like mine because they've reached a point where they don't know what to do. They don't know how to advance things or speed things up or come up with better ideas. So what I would say is if you're going to start it on your own, I will always applaud doing something over doing nothing, always. And I would always look to support that. The internet is a wealth of information about how you could go about adding structure around a new program. Like, I've lost count of how many words I have written on that kind of subject. You know, for my agency, we give away basically the process that we use. It's a download on our site, and we did a webinar on it as well. You know, same principle, because most weaknesses in, yeah, it's first about not having a process to fit everything into. Like, anyone can say, oh, we should run a test, we should test that versus that. Like, you could go and ask 20 people in the street and they'd all give you something, you know, oh, have you tried this? Doesn't mean there's any value in that. So, you know, before you get to that point, what actions are you taking? What are you looking at? How are you, you know, how are you coming up with those ideas? And then, you know, at the end of it, how are you assessing the impact of what you did? And how is that then fueling future, you know, future tests that you want to do? It should be a naturally cyclical process. It's not one test, did it win? Yes, no, okay, move on. Test it. They're not distinct items. It's just a thread that continues to move on. So I think, yeah, if you can find a process or define a process of some kind, it will help. It also helps to legitimize it within the business itself. You know, you're not just charging around making changes, trying to break stuff. Here is how we intend on doing it. And that process will develop and improve over time. And a lot of the time, the improvements come out of you making a mistake. You know, the process in my agency has changed, I have no idea how many times, probably 5 or 6 times a year, every year for the last 6.5 years, because the businesses that we're in, organizations we're working with change, web technology changes, our understanding of the right way to do things or better ways of doing things changes. And when it does, the process changes with it. It doesn't need to be perfect first time. And if you wait for the perfect time, it will never occur. You know, I think I wrote a post a few days ago about, you know, the reasons I've heard people come up with for why they can't run tests right now. I've heard them all, and I understand, and none of them are ridiculous either. They're not people being genuinely obstructive. They're, oh, you know, well, we've got a lot on at the minute, so we're under pressure to deliver, or oh, there's too much in flux at the minute, so, you know, run the test isn't really practical, you know, things like that. And they're right, it does make sense. But there'll never be a point where you're not under pressure to deliver. There will never be a point where, you know, the business stands still, like, in order for you to just run your test. It doesn't work like that. The perfect conditions don't exist. And if you wait for them, you'll do nothing.
Yeah. Maybe it will be a different question, but what do you think? What is the least effective CRO strategy and why?
Doing nothing.
And maybe... Good. A great answer for a great question.
Like getting started, getting the approval to start, you know, if you're in a larger organization, getting the approval to start is one of the hardest bits of them all. Forget about going from 0 to 100. 0 to 1 is the hardest step. You know, getting somebody, or it's often multiple senior stakeholders to go, yeah, okay, that's the hardest part. If you want an answer, which is what's the next worst way of doing it, it is effectively relying on best practices, going to a site that says, oh, here is the best way of doing this, and then just implementing it on your site and expecting that to make a difference. There is no one on the planet that knows exactly what's going to work on your site. Not me, not you, not anyone else. As I always say, you know, when I'm talking to prospects for our agency, it's like, if I had all the answers and I knew exactly what would work, I'd just tell you what to do. I wouldn't run a business that runs tests, would I? I'd just go, yeah, do that. You know, but there is no oracle out there that knows all of those things. So I think the worst approach is do nothing at all. The second worst approach is to think that somebody else has all the answers that you can lift and shift. Someone asked the other day, in 5 words only, what would your best advice to D2C e-commerce business owners be? And mine was, trust me, you don't know.
That's the best.
Yeah. I was quite proud of it, to be honest. You know, it's a good one.
And you mentioned that your CRO mindset also shifted and changed over the years. What stayed as steady as a rock?
Probably that slightly childlike excitement about what's possible. I believe in there being a better way of doing just about everything, whether that's how a website converts or how an email campaign is executed, or even down to how do I spend my time, how I write content. All of these things, all of them, I believe, can be made better. And despite everything that I've learned over the last 11 years or so, and it's a lot, when you look back a few years ago and you think, yeah, I knew quite a lot then. And then you look forward and you're like, ooh, maybe I didn't. Maybe I should have just shut up. But yeah, it is that. I think it's just that continued belief that there is always a better way. I'm just yet to find it. So I might find a better way than I had last year. I believe that in, you know, maybe another year's time, I'll have found an even better way of doing it. I think for most people who work in, you know, in CRO, well, at least ones who work happily in it anyway, you have that kind of, there's always a little excitement when that test goes live. You know, you try not to pin your hopes on it because you're trying to remain objective about things. But if it doesn't excite you that you're one of the people who's driving change within the organizations that you're working in, I think you're in the wrong career.
What are some common challenges that you've encountered in implementing CRO strategies, and how do you overcome them? So this uncertainty and cutting the bush, something like that.
I guess the first one is getting the buy-in in the first place. As I said earlier, that step from 0 to 1, it's always the hardest. I've learned a great deal about that over my years of doing it. I guess, you know, a lot of people who work in CRO are often, they're quite logical individuals. I certainly am. You know, you see data, you see patterns in those, and you see a clear route forwards, you know, and it goes the same for sort of selling in CRO as a process, you're like, well, I can see that change in a business is essential. Businesses that don't change die. And there's countless examples over the years of where that was the case. You know, Kodak, for example, didn't embrace digital, died off. And there's also ones from the UK like Blockbuster, who were a video rental company until streaming arrived.
Offline
and,
Netflix.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. For me, at least, Netflix was online Blockbuster. So, you know, depends how old you are as well.
But, yeah, over 30.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, so, you know, if you can accept that change is essential, it will happen. The question is no longer should we change. The question is how do we change? Every change has inherent risk within it. So you've accepted that it's necessary. You understand that there's risk associated with it. And you're then going, okay, well, what's the best way of trying to combat that risk? Right. And that's why we test, because we don't have all the answers. Now, to me, as a 20-something, when I first started out in this industry, I was like, well, that's just really obvious. But then you talk to somebody else and they'd be coming up with various different reasons as to why they couldn't or shouldn't, or, you know, it would slow stuff down, whatever else. And I could not understand why they couldn't just see the logic in the way that I did. And it's that recognition that someone who, as a guy called Simon Norris, who used to run a big UX agency in the UK called Nemensa, I think he sold it last year. But yeah, he said to me once that human beings make decisions based on emotion and then they justify them with logic afterwards. He probably told me that about 5 years or so ago. And ever since that point, it changed how I perceived what I was selling. It, not even just like in the, you know, the actual selling of it, but, you know, trying to talk to people about what we do. It's like, I was going at the wrong things. I could give them a logical example of why testing is the right thing to do, but that's not going to win it for me. What's going to win it for me is understanding emotionally what they require. And that partly comes down to the scale of the organization that you're dealing with. If you're dealing with a large organization, their biggest emotional driver is fear. They don't want to win. They're desperate not to lose. They've got a lot to lose because they're big, you know, and therefore they often, you know, if they're dominant or fairly dominant within an industry, they've got relatively little to gain by getting larger. They just don't want to tank what they've already got. And also employees within those organizations, they tend to have a similar attitude. You know, culture is a top-down thing. So with them, you're looking at, okay, how do I help them manage risk? You know, and it goes back to that point. There's a structure that I've actually written out for this before, where it's, you get people to understand that change is essential. You then talk to them about changes that have been made in their organization in the past that haven't gone well. And they exist. They're in every organization, right? Yeah, I've made plenty of changes in my business. I go, oh, what was I doing that for? you can have a bit of a laugh about that sort of thing. But what you've got them to understand is that changes that they're doing without testing are risky. And then it's like, okay, so what if we, instead of just rolling those out, what if, you know, we tested one a month, you know, just one a month to begin with, that will help us offset, you know, helps us offset that risk, you know, and if we can keep the site improving iteratively, well, that will offset, you know, the £500,000 you spend every 3 years on a site redesign, because you won't need to anymore, you know, so now you're getting savings. And if there's one, if there's one thing that, you know, senior people love more than getting more money, it's saving money. That's often the emotional element in a large organization. In smaller ones, most of the time it's growth that they want. They have less to lose. So risk management, if you put that forward as an emotional thing, they just don't care. They're like, well, yeah, but we're, you know, because those are often run by entrepreneurs, you know, people who've started businesses within the last, say, 5 years, they're risk takers anyway. If they didn't want to take risks, they'd have stayed in the safe salary job that they had. They wouldn't have gone and started a business. They wouldn't have gone and started a business. So if you start talking to them about risk management, they just, it's like, yeah, no, but what I want is for something to grow, because they see a lot to gain within reason, relatively little to use. So with them, you're looking at explaining, you know, not just test by test, how can this help them, but also bringing that idea of iterative improvement that is built on observed behavior and measurement throughout. You're trying to almost build that in as that's the right way to build a business. You know, forget about CRO and websites for a minute. We're talking about how do you build a business, you know? So for them, the emotional part is growth. It's not, you know, the risk management. We'll talk about that when they hit 50, you know, 100 million turnover, then they'll be like, oh, hold on. Like, you know, I've got something to protect now. And the angle of that changes. So yeah, I think for me, there's the big learning that logic only gets so far. It's the emotional side of things in human beings is significantly more powerful.
If you had the time and energy to write a book or launch a course about CRO, you already made webinars, but other than that, what would be the title of it?
I've not written a book. Courses, I've never done one like in the sort of the Udemy sense of it. I guess I wrote the training programs that we use for developers and for, let's call it co-authored, the developer one. But yeah, for consultants and developers, we use those with other agencies. You know, we train other agencies and also, you know, direct businesses as well. But yeah, what would I call it? It'd probably be something really sad, like the power of process, or, you know, it'd have to be alliterative in some way. Ask me in another 10 years and I'll tell you something different. That's one of the reasons why I write a lot. Like, I don't know how many words I write in a week, but I probably don't get, you know, I reckon each month I probably write enough content for a book. Like, I spend a lot of time writing. But what I've learned over the last, you know, 10, 11 years of doing this is that what I know today is a lot more than I knew even last year or even the year before that. So if I wrote a book, in 5 years time, I'd probably be embarrassed by it.
The title could be like, don't be embarrassed by your by your past self, or something like that. Like self-help book.
Yeah, maybe I'd call it Trust Me, You Don't Know. And we'd go with that.
Yeah, that's the best. And last but not least, I want to give some seeds and nutrition for D2C brands to grow. So I will ask four quick questions and I want some quick answers from you. The first is, what books or influencers would you recommend to read or follow as a D2C brand?
Probably the most important one, Don't Make Me Think. Because even if you just read the title, that would tell you a lot about what you need to do.
Good. The second is, what is the biggest mistake that D2C brands could make? The single biggest one.
Not testing anything and just rolling it out. I call it design and build, deploy and pray.
Great. Channel agnostic. Okay. The third is, could you tell me your quick growth tip related to CRO that they could install the next day that they listen to our podcast?
Ah, yeah. Go and work out what your step conversion rates are. So visit to non-bounce, non-bounce to add to basket, add to basket to sale. And that will tell you where you need to focus.
And the last thing is, what tools would you use as a D2C brand for growth?
Tools?
Yeah, not a shovel. Something.
Right, I would have, I don't want to say I'd use GA4 because I don't really like it, but it's necessary. I would have some form of visual analytics tool. Microsoft Clarity is looking pretty good and doesn't cost anything at the moment. That gives me what is happening in my business and a certain amount of why is happening. I would use Convert, which is a CRO platform, Convert Experiments, because it is very, very well priced for what it is capable of doing. We use it with a lot of our clients. I should say we are tool agnostic as an agency. We use lots of others, but Convert we use quite a bit because of that thing. It won't kill your bank balance to use it, but it will give you the functionality that to run the kind of tests that you would want to run for probably 98% of businesses on the planet would not need something with got more bells and whistles. We find a lot with CRO tools that people might spend tens of thousands of pounds on them, but they don't use half of the functionality that's in it. So what's the point? You've just poured that money away. But yeah, don't spend loads of money on tools. Spend your money on people who know how to use them.
Great. Thanks, Matt, for accepting my call and giving this tremendous amount of value for the listeners.
No problem.
And don't forget to try these tips today. For more seeds and nutrition, stay tuned for the next episode.